He had bulging eyes and this thick, short neck with a dark mole on the back of it. And fists. Fists like bricks. He'd come home and he didn't even have to do anything. Just the sound of his boots in the hallway, the jingle of his keys, his humming. That was enough for me. When he was mad, he always sighed through the nose and pinched his eyes shut, like he was deep in thought. And then he would rub his face and say,
"All right, girlie, all right."
And you knew it was coming, the storm. It was coming, and it could not be stopped. No one could help you. Sometimes just him rubbing his face or the sigh whooshing through his mustache, and I'd see gray. I've crossed paths since with men like him. I wish I could say differently, but I have. And what I've learned is that you dig a little and you find they're all the same, give or take. Some are more polished, granted. They may come with a bit of charm or a lot, and that can fool you. But really, they're all unhappy little boys sloshing around in their own rage. They feel wronged. They haven't been given their due. No one loved them enough. Of course, they expect you to love them. They want to be held, rocked, reassured. But it's a mistake to give it to them. They can't accept it. They can't accept the very thing they're needing. They end up hating you for it. And it never ends because they can't hate you enough. It never ends. The misery, the apologies, the promises, the reneging, the wretchedness of it all. My first husband was like that. I was stunned. No one had ever spoken this plainly in my presence before. Certainly not Mama. No one I knew laid bare their heart locked this way. I felt both embarrassed for Madeline and admiring of her candor. When she mentioned the first husband, I noticed that for the first time since I had met her, a shadow had settled on her face. A momentary intimation of something dark and chastening, wounding, at odds with the energetic laughs and the teasing and the loose pumpkin floor dress she was wearing. I remember thinking at the time, what a good actress she must be to camouflage disappointment and hurt with a veneer of cheerfulness. Like a mask, I thought, and was privately pleased with myself for the clever connection. Later, when I was older, it wasn't as clear to me. Thinking back on it, there was something affected about the way she paused when she mentioned the first husband. The casting down of the gaze, the catch in the throat, the slight quiver of lips, just as there was about the walloping energy and the joking, the lively, heavy-footed charm, the way even her slides landed softly, parachuted by a reassuring wink and laugh. Perhaps they were both trumped-up affectations, or perhaps neither was. It became a blur for me, what was performance and what was real, which at least made me think of her as an infinitely more interesting actress. "How many times did I come running to this house, Odie?" Madeline said, now the smiling again, the swell of laughter. "Your poor parents. But this house was my haven, my sanctuary. It was a little island within the greater one." Mama said, "You were always welcomed here." "It was your mother who put an end to the beatings, Marcus. Did she ever tell you?"
I said she hadn't.
"Hardly surprises me. That's Odilia Varvaris for you."
Mama was unfurling the edge of the apron in her lap and flattening it again with a daydreamy look on her face.
"I came here one night bleeding from the tongue, a patch of hair ripped from the temple, my ears still ringing from the blow. He had really gotten his hooks into me that time. What a state I was in. What a state!"
The way Madeline was telling it, You might have thought she was describing a lavish meal or a good novel.
Your mother doesn't ask because she knows. Of course she knows. She just looks at me for a long time, at me standing there trembling. And she says,
I still remember it, Odie.
She said, well, that's about enough of this business. She says, we are going to pay your father a visit, Maddie. And I start begging. I worried he was going to kill us both. But you know how she can be, your mother.
I said I did, and Mama tossed me a sidelong glance.
She wouldn't listen. She had this look. I'm sure you know the look. She heads out, but not before she picks up her father's hunting rifle. The whole time we are walking to my house, I'm trying to stop her, telling her he hadn't hurt me that bad. But she won't hear it. We walk right up to the door, and there is my father in the doorway. And Odie raises the barrel and shoves it against his chin and says, do it again, and I will come back and shoot you in the face with this rifle. My father blinks, and for a moment he's tongue-tied. He can't say a word. And you want to know the best part, Marcus? I look down and see a little circle. A circle of, well, I think you can guess. A little circle quietly expanding on the floor between his bare feet.
Madeline brushed back her hair and said to another flick of the lighter,
and that, my dear, is a true story.
She didn't have to say it. I knew it was true. I recognized it in Mama's uncomplicated, fierce loyalty, her mountainous resolve, her impulse, her need to be the corrector of injustices, warden of the downtrodden flock. And I could tell it was true from the close-mouthed groan Mama gave at the mention of that last detail. She disapproved. She probably found it distasteful, and not only for the obvious reason. In her view, people, even if they had behaved deplorably in life, deserved a modicum of dignity in death, especially family. Mama shifted in her seat and said,
so if you don't like to travel, Talia, what do you like to do?
All our eyes turned to Talia. Madeline had been speaking for a while. And I recall thinking, as we sat in the courtyard with the sunlight falling in patches all around us, that it was a measure of her capacity to absorb attention, to pull everything into her vortex so thoroughly that Talia had gone forgotten. I also left room for the possibility that they had adapted to this dynamic out of necessity. The quiet daughter, eclipsed by the attention-diverting, self-absorbed mother routine, that Madeline's narcissism was perhaps an act of kindness, of maternal protectiveness. Talia mumbled something.
A little louder, darling,
came the suggestion from Madeline. Talia cleared her throat, a rumbling, phlegmy sound.
Science.
I noticed for the first time the color of her eyes, green like ungrazed pasture. The deep, coarse, dark of her hair, and that she had unblemished skin like her mother. I wondered if she'd been pretty once, maybe even beautiful like Madeline.
Tell them about the sundial, darling,
Madeline said. Talia shrugged.
She built a sundial, Madeline said, right in our backyard last summer. She had no help, not from Andreas, and certainly not from me.
She chortled.
Equatorial or horizontal?
Mama asked. There was a flash of surprise in Talia's eyes, a kind of double take, like a person walking down a crowded street in a foreign city, catching within earshot a snippet of her native tongue.
Horizontal,
she said in that strange, wet voice of hers.
What did you use for a gnomon?
Talia's eyes rested on Mama.
I cut a postcard.
That was the first time I saw how it could be between those two.
She used to take apart her toys when she was little,
Madeline said. She liked mechanical toys, things with inner contraptions. Not that she played with them, did you, darling? No, she would break them up. All those expensive toys opened them as soon as we gave them to her. I used to get into such a state over it, but Andreas, I have to give him credit here. Andreas said to let her, that it was a sign of a curious mind. If you like, we can build one together, Mama said. A sundial, I mean.
I already know how.
Mind your manners, darling, Madeline said, extending, then bending one leg as though she were stretching for a dance routine. And Odie is trying to be helpful.
Maybe something else, then,
Mama said.
We could build some other thing.
Oh,
Madeline said hurriedly, blowing smoke, wheezing.
I can't believe I haven't told you yet, Odie. I have news. Take a guess.
Mama shrugged.
I'm going back to acting. In films, I've been offered the role, the lead, in a major production. Can you believe it?
Congratulations, Mama said flaccidly.
I have the script with me. I'd let you read it, Odie, but I worry you won't like it. Is that bad?
I'd be crushed. I don't mind telling you. I wouldn't get over it. We start shooting in the fall.
The next morning after breakfast, Mama pulled me aside.
All right, what is it? What is wrong with you?
I said I didn't know what she was talking about.
You best drop it. The stupid act. It doesn't suit you, she said.
She had a way of narrowing her eyes and tilting her head just a shade. To this day, it has a grip on me.
I can't do it, Mama. Don't make me.
And why not, exactly?
It came out before I could do a thing about it.
She's a monster.
Mama's mouth became small. She regarded me not with anger, but with a disheartened look, as though I had drawn all the sap out of her. There was a finality to this look. Resignation. Like a sculptor finally dropping mallet and chisel, giving up on a recalcitrant block that will never take the shape he'd pictured.
She is a person who had had a terrible thing happen to her. Call her that name again. I would like to see you. Say it and see what happens.
A little bit later, there we were, Talia and I, walking down a cobblestone path flanked by stone walls on each side. I make sure to walk a few steps ahead so passers-by, or God forbid, one of the boys from the school wouldn't think we were together, which, of course, they would anyway. Anyone could see. At the least, I hoped the distance between us would signal my displeasure and reluctance. To my relief, she didn't make an effort to keep up. We passed sunburned, weary-looking farmers coming home from the market. Their donkeys labored on their wicker baskets containing unsold produce, their hooves clip-clopping on the footpath. I knew most of the farmers, but I kept my head down and averted my eyes. I led Talia to the beach. I chose a rocky one I sometimes went to, knowing it would not be as crowded as some of the other beaches, like Agios Romanos. I rolled up my pants and hopped from one craggy rock to the next, choosing one close to where the waves crashed and retracted. I took off my shoes and lowered my feet into the shallow little pool that had formed between a cluster of stones. A hermit crab scurried away from my toes. I saw Talia to my right settling atop a rock close by. We sat for a long while without talking and watched the ocean rumbling against the rocks. A nippy gust whipped around my ears, spraying the scent of salt on my face. A pelican hovered over the blue-green water, its wings spread. Two ladies stood side by side, knee-deep in the water, their skirts held up high. To the west, I had a view of the island.
the dominant white of the homes and windmills, the green of the barley fields, the dull brown of the jagged mountains from which springs flowed every year. My father died on one of those mountains. He worked for Green Marble Quarry, and one day, when Mama was 6 months pregnant with me, he slipped off a cliff and fell 100 feet. Mama said he had forgotten to secure his safety harness.
"You should stop,"
Talia said. I was tossing pebbles into an old galvanized tin pail nearby, and she startled me. I missed. "What's it to you?"
"I mean flattering yourself. I don't want this any more than you do."
The wind was making her hair flap, and she was holding down the mask against her face. I wondered if she lived with this fear daily, that the gust of wind would rip it from her face and she would have to chase after it exposed. I didn't say anything. I tossed another pebble and missed again.
"You are an ass,"
she said. After a while, she got up, and I pretended to stay. Then I looked over my shoulder and saw her heading up the beach, back toward the road, and so I put my shoes back on and followed her home. When we returned, Mama was mincing okra in the kitchen, and Madeline was sitting nearby, doing her nails and smoking, tapping the ash into a saucer. I cringed with some horror when I saw that the saucer belonged to the china set Mama had inherited from her grandmother. It was the only thing of any real value that Mama owned, the china set, and she hardly ever took it down from the shelf up near the ceiling where she kept it. Madeline was blowing on her nails in between drags and talking about Patakos, Papadopoulos, and Makarezos, the three colonels who had staged a military coup, the general's coup, as it was known then, earlier that year in Athens. She was saying she knew a playwright, a dear, dear man, as she described him, who had been in prison under the charge of being a communist subversive.
"Which is absurd, of course, just absurd. You know what they do to people? The ESA to make them talk?"
She was saying this in a low voice, as if the military police were hiding somewhere in the house.
"They put a hose in your behind and turn on the water full blast. It's true, Odie, I swear to you. They soak rags in the filthiest things, human filth, you understand? And shove them in people's mouths."
"That's awful," Mama said flatly. I wonder if she was already tiring of Madeline. The stream of puffed up political opinions, the tales of parties Madeline had attended with her husband, the poets and intellectuals and musicians she had clinked champagne flutes with, the list of needless, senseless trips she had taken to foreign cities, trotting out her views on nuclear disaster and overpopulation and pollution. Mama indulged Madeline, smiling through her stories with a look of wry bemusement, but I knew she thought unkindly of her. She probably thought Madeline was flaunting. She probably felt embarrassed for her. This is what rankles, what pollutes Mama's kindness, her rescues, and her acts of courage. The indebtedness that shadows them. The demands, the obligations she saddles you with. The way she uses these acts as currency, with which she barters for loyalty and allegiance. I understand now why Madeline left all those years ago. The rope that pulls you from the flood can become a noose around your neck. People always disappoint Mama in the end, me included. They can't make good on what they owe. Not the way Mama expects them to. Mama's consolation prize is the grim satisfaction of holding the upper hand, free to pass verdicts from the perch of strategic advantage, since she is always the one who has been wronged. It saddens me because of what it reveals to me about Mama's own neediness, her own anxiety, her fear of loneliness, her dread of being stranded, abandoned. And what does it say about me that I know this about my mother, that I know precisely what she needs, and yet how deliberately and unswervingly I have denied her. Taking care to keep an ocean, a continent, or preferably both between us for the better part of 3 decades. They have no sense of irony, the junta, Madeline was saying. Crushing people as they do in Greece, the birthplace of democracy. Ah, there you are. Well, how was it? What did you two get up to?
We played at the beach, Talia said.
Was it fun? Did you have fun?
We had a grand time, Talia said.
Mama's eyes jumped skeptically from me to Talia and back, but Madeline beamed and applauded silently.
Good, now that I don't have to worry about you two getting along, Odie and I can spend some time of our own together. What do you say, Odie?
We have so much catching up to do still.
Mama smiled gamely and reached for a head of cabbage. From then on, Talia and I were left to our own devices. We were to explore the island, play games at the beach, amuse ourselves the way children are expected to. Mama would pack us a sandwich each, and we would set off together after breakfast. Once out of sight, we often drifted apart. At the beach, I took a swim or lay on a rock with my shirt off, while Talia went off to collect shells or skip rocks underwater, which was no good because the waves were too big. We went walking along the footpaths that snaked through vineyards and barley fields, looking down at our own shadows, each preoccupied and with our own thoughts. Mostly, we wandered. There wasn't much in the way of a tourist industry on Tinos in those days. It was a farming island, really, people living off their cows and goats and olive trees and wheat. We would end up bored eating lunch somewhere, quietly, in the shade of a tree or a windmill, looking between bites at the ravines, the fields of thorny bushes, the mountains, the sea. One day, I wandered off toward town. We lived on the southwestern shore of the island, and Tina's town was only a few miles walk south. There was a little knick-knack shop there, run by a heavy-faced widower named Mr. Rosos. On any given day, you were apt to find in the window of his shop anything from a 1940s typewriter to a pair of leather work boots, or a weather vane, an old plant stand, giant wax candles, a cross, or of course, copies of the Panagia Evangelistaria icon, or maybe even a brass gorilla. He was also an amateur photographer and had a makeshift darkroom in the back of the shop. When the pilgrims came to Tinos every August to visit the icon, Mr. Russo sold rolls of film to them and developed their photos in his darkroom for a fee. About a month back, I had spotted a camera in his display window, sitting on its worn rust-colored leather case. Every few days, I strolled over to the shop, stared at this camera, and imagined myself in India, the leather case hanging by the strap over my shoulder, taking photos of the paddies and tea estates I had seen in National Geographic. I would shoot the Inca Trail, on camelback, in some dust-choked old truck, or on foot. I would brave the heat until I stood up gazing up at the Sphinx and the pyramids, and I would shoot them too, and see my photos published in magazines with glossy pages. This was what drew me to Mr. Russo's window that morning, though the shop was closed for the day, to stand outside, my forehead pressed to the glass, and daydream.
What kind is it?
I pulled back a bit, caught Talia's reflection in the window. She dabbed at her left cheek with a handkerchief.
The camera.
I shrugged.
Looks like a C3 Angus, she said. How would you know? It's only the best-selling 35mm in the world for the last 30 years, she said, a little chidingly. Not much to look at, though. It's ugly. It looks like a brick. So you want to be a photographer? You know, when you are all grown up? Your mother says you do.
I turned around. Mama told you that? So? I shrugged. I was embarrassed that Mama had discussed this with Talia. I wonder how she said it.
She could unsheathe from her arsenal a mockingly grave way of talking about things she found either portentous or frivolous.
She could shrink your aspirations before your very eyes.
Marcus wants to walk the earth and capture it with his lens.
Talia sat on the sidewalk and pulled her skirt over her knees. It was a hot day, the sun biting the skin like it had teeth. Hardly anyone was out and about, except for an elderly couple trudging stiffly up the street. The husband, Demis something, wore a gray flat cap and a brown tweed jacket that looked too heavy for the season. He had a frozen, wide-eyed look to his face, I remember, the way some old people do, like they are perpetually startled by the monstrous surprise that is old age. It wasn't until years later in medical school that I suspected he had Parkinson's. They waved as they passed, and I waved back. I saw them take notice of Talia, a momentary pause in their stride, and then they moved on.
"Do you have a camera?"
Talia said.
"No." "Have you ever taken a picture?"
"No."
"And you want to be a photographer?"
"You find that strange?"
"A little.
Say, if I said I wanted to be a policeman, you'd think that was strange too? Because I never slapped handcuffs on anyone?"
I could tell from the softening in her eyes that, if she could, she would be smiling.
"So you are a clever ass," she said. "Word of advice, don't mention the camera in my mother's presence or she will buy it for you. She's very eager to please."
The handkerchief went to the cheek and back.
"But I doubt that Odilia would approve. I guess you already know that."
I was both impressed and a little unsettled by how much she seemed to have grasped in so little time. Maybe it was the mask, I thought. The advantage of cover, the freedom to be watchful, to observe and scrutinize.
"She would probably make you give it back."
I sighed. It was true. Mama would not allow such easy amends, and most certainly not if it involved money. Talia rose to her feet and beat the dust from her behind.
"Let me ask you, do you have a box at home?"
Madeline was sipping wine with Mama in the kitchen, and Talia and I were upstairs, using black markers on a shoebox. The shoebox belonged to Madeline and contained a new pair of lime green leather pumps with high heels, still wrapped in tissue paper.
"Where was she planning on wearing those?"
I asked. I could hear Madeline downstairs, talking about an acting class she had once taken where the instructor had asked her, as an exercise, to pretend she was a lizard, sitting motionless on a rock. A swell of laughter, hers, followed. We finished the second coat, and Talia said we should put on a third, to make sure we hadn't missed any spots. The black had to be uniform and flawless.
"That's all a camera is," she said. "A black box with a hole to let in the light and something to absorb the light. Give me the needle."
I passed her a sewing needle of Mama's. I was skeptical, to say the least, about the prospects of this homemade camera. Of it doing anything at all, a shoebox and a needle? But Talia had attacked the project with such faith and self-assured confidence that I had to leave room for the unlikely possibility that it just might work. She made me think she knew things I did not.
"I made some calculations," she said,
carefully piercing the box with the needle.
"Without a lens, we cannot set the pinhole on the small face. The box is too long. But the width is just about right. The key is to make the correct size pinhole. I figured 0.6 millimeter roughly. There. Now we need a shutter."
Downstairs, Madeline's voice had dropped to a low, urgent murmur. I couldn't hear what she was saying, but I could tell that she was speaking more slowly than before, enunciating well, and I pictured her leaning forward, elbows on knees, making eye contact, not blinking. Over the years, I've come to know this tone of voice intimately. When people speak this way, they're likely disclosing, revealing, confessing some catastrophe, beseeching the listener. It's a staple of the military's casualty notification teams knocking on doors, lawyers touting the merits of plea deals to clients, policemen stopping cars at 3 a.m., cheating husbands. How many times have I used it myself at hospitals here in Kabul? How many times have I guided entire families into a quiet room, asked them to sit, pulled the chair up for myself, gathering the will to give them news, dreading the coming conversation?
She's talking about Andreas,
Talia said evenly.
I bet she is. They had a big fight. Pass me the tape and those scissors. What is he like, beside being rich, I mean?
Who, Andreas? He's all right. He travels a lot. When he's home, he always has people over. Important people, ministers, generals, that kind. They have drinks by the fireplace and they talk all night, mostly business and politics. I can hear them from my room. I'm supposed to stay upstairs when Andreas has company. I'm not supposed to come down, but he buys me things. He pays for a tutor to come to the house, and he speaks to me nicely enough.
She taped a rectangular piece of cardboard, which was also colored black, over the pinhole. Things were quiet downstairs. I choreographed the scene in my head. Madeline weeping without the sound, absently fiddling with a handkerchief like it was a clump of Play-Doh. Maman not much help, looking on stiffly with a pinch-faced little smile like she's got something sour melting under her tongue. Mama can't stand it when people cry in her presence. She can barely look at their puffy eyes, their open, pleading faces. She sees crying as a sign of weakness, a garish appeal for attention, and she won't indulge it. She can't bring herself to console. Growing up, I learned that it was not one of her strong suits. Sorrow ought to be private, she thinks, not flaunted. Once when I was little, I asked her if she cried when my father had fallen to his death.
At the funeral? I mean, the burial?
No, I did not.
Because you weren't sad?
Because it was nobody's business if I was.
Would you cry if I died, Mama?
Let's hope we never have to find out, she said.
Talia picked up the box of photographic paper and said,
Get the flashlight.
We moved into Mama's closet, taking care to shut the door and snuff out daylight with towels we stuffed under it. Once we were in pitch darkness, Talia asked me to turn on the flashlight, which we had covered with several layers of red cellophane. All I could see of Talia in the dim glow was her slender fingers as she cut a sheet of photographic paper and taped it to the inside of the shoebox opposite the pinhole. We had bought the paper from Mr. Russo's shop the day before. When we walked up to the counter, Mr. Russo peered at Talia over his spectacles and said,
Is this a robbery?
Talia pointed an index finger at him and cocked her thumb like pulling back the hammer. Talia closed the lid on the shoebox, covered the pinhole with the shutter. In the dark, she said,
Tomorrow, you shoot the first photo of your career.
I couldn't tell if she was making fun or not. We chose the beach. We set the shoebox on the flat rock and secured it firmly with rope. Talia said we couldn't have any movement at all when we opened the shutter. She moved in next to me and took a peek over the box as if through a viewfinder.
It's a perfect shot, she said. Almost. We need a subject.
She looked at me, saw what I meant, and said,
No, I won't do it.
We argued back and forth, and she finally agreed, but on the condition that her face didn't show. She took off her shoes, walked atop a row of rocks a few feet in front of the camera, using her arms like a tightrope walker on a cable. She lowered herself on the rocks, facing west in the direction of Syros and Kitnas. She flipped her hair so it covered the bands at the back of her head that held the mask in place. She looked at me over her shoulder.
Remember,
she shouted.
Count to 120.
She turned back to face the sea. I stooped and peered over the box, looking at Talia's back, the constellation of rocks around her, the whips of seaweed entangled between them like dead snakes, a little tugboat bobbing in the distance, the tide rising, mashing the craggy shore and withdrawing. I lifted the shutter from the pinhole and began to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We are lying in bed. On the TV screen, a pair of accordion players are dueling, but Gianna has turned off the sound. Midday sunlight scissors through the blinds, falling in stripes on the remains of the margarita pizza we'd ordered for lunch from room service. It was delivered to us by a tall, slim man with impeccable, slicked back hair with a white coat and black tie. On the table he rolled into the room was a flute vase with a red rose in it. He lifted the dome plate cover of the pizza with great flourish, making a sweeping motion with his hand like a magician to his audience after the rabbit has materialized from the top hat. Scattered around us among the moss sheets are the pictures I've shown Gianna, photos of my trips over the past year and a half. Belfast, Montevideo, Tangier, Marseille, Lima, Tehran. I show her photos of the commune I had joined briefly in Copenhagen, living alongside ripped t-shirt and beanie hat wearing Danish beatniks who had built a self-governing community on a former military base.
Where are you? Gianna asked. You're not in the photographs.
I like being behind the lens better, I say. It's true. I've taken hundreds of pictures and you won't find me in any. I always order two sets of prints when I drop off the film. I keep one set, mail the other to Talia back home. Gianna asks how I finance my trips, and I explain I pay for them with inheritance money. This is partially true, because the inheritance is Talia's, not mine. Unlike Madeline, who for obvious reasons was never mentioned in Andreas's will, Talia was. She gave me half her money. I'm supposed to be putting myself through university with it. 8, 9, 10. Gianna props herself up on her elbows and leans across the bed over me, her small breasts brushing my skin. She fetches her pack, lights a cigarette. I met her the day before at Piazza di Spagna. I was sitting on the stone steps that connect the square below to the church on the hill. She walked up and said something to me in Italian. She looked like so many of the pretty, seemingly aimless girls I'd seen slinking around Rome's churches and piazzas. They smoked and talked loudly and laughed a lot. I shook my head and said, "Sorry?" She smiled and went, "Ah." And then, in heavily accented English, said, "Lighter cigarette." I shook my head and told her in my own heavily accented English that I didn't smoke. She grinned. Her eyes were bright and jumping. The late morning sun made a nimbus around her diamond-shaped face. I doze off briefly and wake up to her poking my ribs.
"La tua ragazza?"
she says. She has found the picture of Talia on the beach, the one I had taken years before with our homemade pinhole camera.
"Your girlfriend?"
"No," I say.
"Your sister?"
"No."
"La tua cugina?" "Your cousin, see?"
I shake my head. She studies the photo some more, taking quick drags of her cigarette.
"No?"
she says sharply. To my surprise, even angrily.
"Questa è la tua ragazza, your girlfriend. I think yes, you're a liar."
And then to my disbelief, she flicks her lighter and sets the picture on fire. 14, 15, 16, 17. About midway through our trek back to the bus stop, I realize I've lost the photo. I tell him I need to go back. There is no choice. I have to go back. Alfonso, a wiry, tight-lipped Waso, who's tagging along as our informal Chilean guide, looks questioningly at Gary. Gary is an American. He's the alpha male in our trio. He has dirty blonde hair and acne pits on his cheeks. It's a face that hints at habitual hard living. Gary is in a foul mood, made worse by hunger, the absence of alcohol, and the nasty rash he has on his right calf, which he contracted brushing up against a leather shrub the day before. I met them both at the crowded bar in Santiago, where after half a dozen rounds of piscolas, Alfonso had suggested a hike to the waterfall at Salto de Apoquindo, where his father used to take him when he was a boy. We'd made the hike the next day and had camped out at the waterfall for the night. We'd smoked dope, the water roaring in our ears, a wide-open sky crammed with stars above us. We were trudging back now towards San Carlos de Apoquindo to catch the bus. Gary pushes back the wide rim of his cordovan hat and wipes his brow with a handkerchief.
"It's a 3-hour walk back, Marcos," he says.
"Tres horas, ¿agle comprende?" Alfonso echoes.
"I know."
"And you are still going?"
"Yes."
"Para una foto,"
Alfonso says. I nod. I keep quiet because they would not understand. I'm not sure I understand it myself.
"You know you are going to get lost," Gary says.
"Probably."
"That good luck, amigo,"
Gary says, offering his hand.
"Es un griego loco,"
Alfonso says. I laugh. It is not the first time I had been called a crazy Greek. We shake hands. Gary adjusts the straps of his knapsack, and the two of them head back up the trail along the folds of the mountain, Gary waving once without looking as they take a hairpin turn. I walk back the way we had come. It takes me 4 hours, actually, because I do get lost as Gary had predicted. I'm exhausted by the time I reach the campsite. I search all over, kicking bushes, looking between rocks, dread building as I rummage in vain. Then, just as I try to resign myself to the worst, I spot a flash of white in a batch of shrubs up a shallow slope. I find the photo wedged between a tangle of brambles. I pluck it free, beat dust from it, my eyes brimming with tears of relief. 23, 24, 25. In Caracas, I sleep under a bridge, a youth hostel in Brussels. Sometimes I splurge and rent a room in a nice hotel, take long hot showers, shave, eat meals in a bathrobe. I watch color TV. The cities, the roads, the countrysides, and the people I meet, they all begin to blur. I tell myself I'm searching for something, but more and more it feels like I am wandering, waiting for something to happen to me. Something that will change everything. Something that my whole life has been leading up to. 34, 35, 36. My fourth day in India. I totter down a dirt road among stray cattle, the world tilting under my feet. I've been vomiting all day. My skin is the yellow of a sari, and it feels like invisible hands are peeling it raw. When I can't walk anymore, I lie down on the side of the road. An old man across the road stirs something in a big steel pot. Beside him is a cage. Inside the cage, a blue and red parrot. A dark-skinned vendor pushing a cart full of empty green bottles passes me by. That's the last thing I remember. 41, 42. I wake up in a big room. The air is thick with heat and something like rotting cantaloupe. I'm lying on a twin-sized steel-frame bed, cushioned from the hard, springless platform by a mattress no thicker than a paperback book. The room is filled with beds like mine. I see emaciated arms dangling over the side, dark matchstick legs protruding from stained sheets, scantooth mouths open, idle ceiling fans, walls marked by patches of mold. The window beside me lets in hot, sticky air and sunlight that stabs the eyeballs. The nurse, a burly, glowering Muslim man named Gul, tells me I may die of hepatitis. 55, 56, 57. I ask for my backpack.
What backpack?
Gul says with indifference. All my things are gone. My clothes, my cash, my books, my camera.
That's all the thief left you,
Gul says in his rolling English, pointing to the windowsill beside me. It's the picture. I pick it up. Talia, her hair flapping in the breeze, the water bubbling with froth around her, her bare feet on the rocks, the leaping Aegean flung out before her. A lump rises to my throat. I don't want to die here, among these strangers, so far away from her. I tuck the photo in the wedge between the glass and the window frame. 66, 67, 68. The boy in the bed next to mine has an old man's face, haggard, sunken, carved. His lower belly is swollen with a tumor the size of a bowling ball. Whenever a nurse touches him there, his eyes squeeze shut and his mouth springs open in a silent, agonizing wail. This morning, one of the nurses, not Gul, is trying to feed him pills, but the boy turns his head side to side, his throat making a sound like a scraping against wood. Finally, the nurse pries his mouth open, forces the pills inside. When he leaves, the boy rolls his head slowly toward me. We eye each other across the space between our beds. A small tear squeezes out and rolls down his cheek. 75, 76, 77. The suffering, the despair in this place is like a wave. It rolls out from every bed, smashes against the moldy walls, and swoops back toward you. You can drown in it. I sleep a lot. When I don't, I itch. I take the pills they give me, and the pills make me sleep again. Otherwise, I look down at the bustling street outside the dormitory, at the sunlight skidding over tent bazaars and back alley tea shops. I watch the kids shooting marbles on the sidewalk that melt into muddy gutters, the old women sitting in doorways, the street vendors in dhotis squatting on their mats, scraping coconuts, hawking marigold garlands. Someone lets out an ear-splitting shriek from across the room. I doze off. 83, 84, 85. I learned that the boy's name is Manar. It means guiding light. His mother was a prostitute, his father a thief. He lived with his aunt and uncle who beat him. No one knows exactly what is killing him, only that it is. No one visits him. And when he dies, a week from now, a month, two at the outside, no one will come to claim him. No one will grieve. No one will remember. He will die where he lived, in the cracks. When he sleeps, I find myself looking at him, at his crated temples, the head that's too big for his shoulders, the pigmented scar on his lower lip where, Gul informed me, his mother's pimp had the habit of putting out his cigarette. I try speaking to him in English, then in the few Urdu words I know, but he only blinks tiredly. Sometimes I put my hands together and make shadow animals on the wall to win a smile from him. 87, 88, 89. One day, Manar points to something outside my window. I follow his finger, raise my head, but I see nothing but the blue wisp of sky through the clouds. Children below playing with water gushing from the street pump. A bus spewing exhaust. Then I realize he's pointing at the photo of Talia. I pluck it from the window and hand it to him. He holds it close to his face by the burnt corner and stares at it for a long time. I wonder if it is the ocean that draws him. I wonder if he has ever tasted salt water or got dizzy watching the tide pull away from his feet. Or perhaps, though he cannot see her face, he senses a kin in Talia, someone who knows what pain feels like. He goes to hand the photo back to me. I shake my head. Hold on to it, I say. A shadow of mistrust crosses his face. I smile, and I can't be sure, but I think he smiles back. 92, 93, 94. I beat the hepatitis. Strange how I cannot tell if Goal is pleased or disappointed at my having proved him wrong. But I know I've caught him by surprise when I ask if I can stay on as a volunteer. He cocks his head, frowns. I end up having to talk to one of the head nurses. 97, 98, 99. The shower room smells like urine and sulfur. Every morning I carry Manar into it, holding his naked body in my arms, careful not to bounce him. I'd watched one of the volunteers carry him before over the shoulder as if he were a bag of rice. I gently lower him onto the bench and wait for him to catch his breath. I rinse his small, frail body with warm water. Manar always sits quietly, patiently, palms on his knees, head hung low. He is like a fearful, bony old man. I run the soapy sponge over his ribcage, the knobs of his spine, over shoulder blades that jut out like shark fins. I carry him back to his bed, feed him his pills. It suits him to have his feet and calves massaged, so I do that for him, taking my time. When he sleeps, it is always with a picture of Talia half tucked under his pillow. 101, 102. I go for long, aimless walks around the city, if only to get away from the hospital, the collective breaths of the sick and dying. I walk in dusty sunsets through streets lined with graffiti-stained walls, past tin-shed stalls packed tightly against one another, crossing paths with little girls carrying basketfuls of raw dung on their head, women covered in black soot boiling rags in huge aluminum vats. I think a lot about Manar as I meander down a cat's cradle of narrow alleyways, Manar waiting to die in that room full of broken figures like him. I think a lot about Talia, sitting on the rock, looking out at the sea. I sense something deep inside me drawing me in, tugging at me like an undertow. I want to give in to it, be seized by it. I want to give up my bearings, slip out of who I am, shed everything, the way a snake discards old skin. I'm not saying Manar changed everything. He didn't. I stumble around the world for still another year before I finally find myself at the corner desk in an Athens library, looking down at the medical school application. In between Manar and the application are the 2 weeks I spent in Damascus, of which I have virtually no memory other than the grinning faces of two women with heavily lined eyes and a gold tooth each. or the 3 months in Cairo in the basement of a ramshackle tenement run by hashish-addicted landlord. I spent Talia's money riding buses in Iceland, tagging along with a punk band in Munich. In 1977, I break an elbow at an anti-nuclear protest in Bilbao. But in my quiet moments, in those long rides in the back of a bus or the bed of a truck, my mind always circles back to Manar, thinking of him, of the anguish of his final days, and my own helplessness in the face of it, makes everything I have done, everything I want to do, seem as unsubstantial as the little vows you make yourself as you are going to sleep, the ones you have already forgotten by the time you wake up. 119, 120. I dropped the shutter. One night at the end of the summer, I learned that Madeline was leaving for Athens and leaving Talia with us, at least for a short while. "Just for a few weeks," she said. We were having dinner, the four of us, a dish of white bean soup that Mama and Madeline had prepared together. I glanced across the table at Talia to see if I was the only one on whom Madeline had sprung the news. It appeared I was. Talia was calmly feeding spoonfuls of soup into her mouth, lifting her mask just a bit with each trip of the spoon. By then, her speech and eating didn't bother me anymore, or at least no more than watching an old person eating through ill-fitting dentures, like Mama would years later. Madeline said she would send for Talia after she had shot her film, which she said should wrap well before Christmas. "Actually, I will bring you all to Athens," she said, her face rings with the customary cheer. "And we will go to the opening together. Wouldn't that be marvelous, Marcus? The four of us dressed up, waltzing into the theater in style." I said it would be, though I had trouble picturing Mama in a fancy gown or waltzing into anything. Madeline explained how it would work out just fine, how Talia could resume her studies when school opened in a couple of weeks, at home, of course, with Mama. She said she would send us postcards and letters and pictures of the film set. She said more, but I didn't hear much of it. What I was feeling was enormous relief and outright giddiness. My dread of the coming end of summer was like a knot in my belly, winding tighter with each passing day as I steeled myself against the approaching farewell. I woke every morning now eager to see Talia at the breakfast table, to hear the bizarre sound of her voice. We barely ate before we were out climbing trees, chasing each other through barley fields, plowing through the stalks and letting out war cries, lizards scattering away from our feet. We stashed make-believe treasures in caves, found spots on the island with the best and loudest echoes. We shot photos of windmills and dovecotes with our pinhole camera and took them to Mr. Russo's, who developed them for us. He even let us into his darkroom and taught us about different developers, fixers, and stop baths. The night of Madeline's announcement, she and Mama shared a bottle of wine in the kitchen, Madeline doing most of the drinking, while Talia and I were upstairs playing a game of tavli. Talia had the mana position and had already moved half her checkers onto her home board. "She has a lover," Talia said, rolling the dice. I jumped. "Who?" "Who?" he says. "Who do you think?" I had learned over the course of the summer to read Talia's expressions through her eyes, and she was looking at me now like I was standing on the beach asking where the water was. I tried to recover quickly. "I know who," I said, my cheeks burning. "I mean, who is the, you know?" I was a 12-year-old boy. My vocabulary didn't include words like lover. "Can't you guess?"
The director. I was going to say that.
Alias. He's something. He plasters his hair down like it's the 1920s. He has a thin little mustache too. I guess he thinks it makes him look rakish. He's ridiculous. He thinks he's a great art